Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Monica Schock-Spanna, co-chair of the Working Group on Equity in COVID-19 Vaccination. Communivax is a national consortium of experts and advocates involved in the vaccine process. She's also a medical anthropologist and senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. She talks about their new report, Equity in Vaccination, a plan to work with communities of color toward COVID-19 recovery and beyond. Roy Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Monica Schock-Spanna here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Monica Schock-Spanna, co-chair of the Working Group on Equity in COVID-19 Vaccinations, Communivax, a national consortium of experts and advocates involved in the vaccine process. They just released a detailed report advising state and local governments on how to support vaccination campaign that works for people of color.
Dr. Schock-Spanna is a medical anthropologist and senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Her team has been examining many challenges from the COVID-19 pandemic, from vaccine readiness to mental health. She's an advisor to Homeland Security. Monica, we welcome you to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
Well, you know, the Communivax is such an important initiative. Community leaders, public health experts, healthcare providers, vaccinologists, the team was brought together in last November, to sort of create guidelines to ensure that communities of color gain equal access to COVID-19 vaccines. I wonder if you could just tell our listeners more about the Communivax initiative, who the partners are, and how this report came together.
The Communivax Coalition has three major components. The first is a coordinating hub that includes social and cultural, political, operational, and social justice perspectives on COVID-19 vaccination. Mm-hmm. But the coordination is of five local research teams that are embedded in their own local communities and working with public health implementers and applying what we call an ethnographic perspective on COVID-19 vaccination delivery, communication, and uptake. That means community-centric and also from the perspective of an insider. Mm-hmm. We are benefiting greatly nationally from surveys at the national level. The rollout of the vaccination campaign really can benefit from the more granular understandings that mm-hmm. people have about what vaccination means to them and what's keeping them from being vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So we have teams in Maryland, Alabama, Idaho, and California along a rural and urban continuum, current presence in Latino communities and also Black communities.
Well, Monica, your team at Hopkins has been working on how to best prepare the public at large for vaccine readiness. And we know there's been hesitancy across the broader population and perhaps in particular in communities of color. Your report has five key actions that you've identified that will promote greater awareness of the vaccine safety, its efficacy, how well it works. So share with our listeners those the five I's that you identify in this report. And as a medical anthropologist, I think you understand so well why effective communication is at the very core of these objectives. So maybe share a little bit about that with us.
We've put forth the 5I framework for state and local officials to think about how they can advance equity within COVID-19 vaccination campaigns in their backyards. And the first is iteration, which means ongoing improvement and consistency and steadfastness. And what we mean by iteration is that in the vaccination campaign, there is the urgent work of vaccinating as many people as possible. On the other hand, there is another critical work stream, which is the trust building that must transpire between government, public health, and communities of color. And there needs to be ongoing exchanges between public health and their constituents of color. So that's iteration. The second is involvement. Oftentimes there's a sense if only we deliver the scientifically accurate information in culturally sensitive and personally meaningful ways, then people will just come around to be vaccinated. And what we're saying with the involvement principle is that public health needs to consider members of these hard hit communities as co-creators of vaccination delivery and communication systems. They're not passive bystanders. And there is a great deal of community-related data and community knowledge that needs to be tapped for this vaccination campaign to succeed. Information is about getting the information that can inform decision-making by people of color. And again, it's not just packaging the science so that it's more accessible. At the same time, we need to sit and listen to what the perspectives and inputs are of communities of color, where vaccination plays a role in their experiences of the COVID-19 response, and what it means going forward in terms of economic and social and health and well-being. I think where our Communivax group departs a little bit from other work on vaccine confidence and access are on the two additional I's. The first is investment and lastly, integration. Mm-hmm. What we'd like for the implementers of the vaccination systems is to think about the vaccination campaign not simply as a public health intervention, a one-time, one-off public health intervention. It is indeed an economic enterprise that can be mobilized to advance community development and economic revitalization goals within hard-hit communities of color. And then with integration, our point here is that vaccination may be kicking off and accelerating a process of recovery. But we have not in the United States engaged in, particularly at the community level, cross-sector integrated planning for a comprehensive and holistic form of recovery from the pandemic. There's certainly a focus on vaccination, and there's also a focus on jumpstarting the economy. But we also need to think about mental health, our emergency management systems, our healthcare delivery systems. How are we going to improve all of those so we don't have disproportionate impacts in the future?
Dr. Shakspana, I love so much of what you said and the Five Eyes initiative that you have, and but really trying to build trust, having the BIPOC community as part co-creator of this effort, and then looking forward. And I really want to talk about looking forward because I know you see this unique opportunity to create a lasting improvement in the public health infrastructure. Talk to us a little bit about the aspect of the plan that goes beyond getting one or two shots in the arm, and those are important shots, but how do we leverage this moment to make something more meaningful, impactful, and long-lasting in the system?
Yes, let me spotlight two concrete objectives. The first is the strengthening of the public health infrastructure such that public health practitioners can create genuine relationships through which they engage their community partners. We all know about the under-resourcing of the public health infrastructure in the United States, but there is a story embedded in there, and that is the under-resourcing in particular of the organizational capacities for communication, community engagement, and we have not equipped our health departments strategically or in terms of resources or personnel, such that they can do the longstanding work of strengthening trust, building it where there is none. And so we need personnel operating budgets and investment of an executive's own time in the community engagement work that is essential to public health practice in the United States. So there's strengthening of the public health infrastructure for community engagement. At the same time, we also need to create and finance a coherent public health sector in the United States. We have community health workers who have deep roots, particularly in BIPOC communities, and who play an essential role on an everyday basis to help surface and meet the health and wellness needs of BIPOC communities. But we do it in a very ad hoc, unsystematic way, and our financing systems in the United States do not invest in the community health sector. We may have a public health infrastructure that's underfunded. We may have a fragmented, mostly for-profit healthcare sector, but even more in need of cohesion and coherence is the community health sector. And we don't have the financing mechanisms to do that just yet.
Well, Monica, you raised such great points. And one of the areas that is now really bubbling up in the news every day, first was, can we get the vaccine? And then it's, can we distribute the vaccine? And now it is, who are we distributing the vaccine to, right? And we started with our over 75 year old population, but a lot of attention now to, are we getting this to the hardest hit communities? Are we getting it to diverse communities and communities of color? And one of the I don't know if it's a criticism or a commentary I'm hearing is that maybe the VAMS, the Vaccine Administration Management System that was developed, maybe it's not where it needed to be around being able to track racial and demographic data. I wonder if you can just sort of educate us, where are we at this point at being able to report that out in a meaningful level? Are we relying entirely on self-report of patients, which may include a choice not to? Are we looking at census tract data or predictive analytics or anything to give us as robust a sense as possible about whether we're hitting the mark and getting vaccine distributed in an equitable way?
You know, data is absolutely key to achieving equity objectives. We know as a nation that we have not done a good job of tracking in a very systematic way the impacts on racial and ethnic minorities in the United States. So there's the impact of the pandemic to begin with.
Right.
There are issues also of distribution systems that are in place, and does their location map, for instance, on GIS maps of areas of need. We also need to do a better job of tracking, as you said, the uptake across different demographics. So it includes racial and ethnic minority groups, but because these groups are not homogenous, we also need to pay attention to age and gender and also intersectionality with education. Mm-hmm. I think data is important because it puts a fine point on a reality that there is inequity in the United States that can be reversed, but we need to have a monitoring system that allows us to baseline where we are, where we can make adjustments along the way and shift so that we're improving. I think also it takes a lot of political courage in the United States to tackle issues like systemic racism. Mm-hmm. And the more objective data we have to say, look, we can show you quite factually that there are disproportionate effects. We need to create policies that remedy those. So data, it puts a boundary around an otherwise socially contentious and politically touchy subject, and provides leaders the courage they need to tackle something like systemic racism. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking today with Dr. Monica Shock-Spana, co-chair of the Working Group on Equity in COVID-19 Vaccinations, Communivax, a national consortium of experts and advocates involved in the vaccine process, just released a report titled Equity in Vaccination, a plan to work with communities of color toward COVID-19 recovery and beyond. Dr. Shock-Spana, I want to go back to your note earlier that we're under-resourcing our health departments and our public health systems. I think that's such an important observation. As you start to think about this grassroots, local level activity that goes on, what are the resources that will be needed? And how do you see sort of the partnership, maybe reimagining the public and private partnership that could yield some meaningful results? This pandemic laid bare the really terrible condition that our country has at this local public health level. Talk to us about some of the creative, imaginative partnerships that might exist out there.
Well, to speak to your first question, which is sort of the limited capabilities within public health departments, I should note that I conducted two national surveys among local health departments in the United States to try and understand better what resources and practices they were using to engage community partners in the larger public health emergency management system. And those health departments that excelled at what we called intense public engagement, that is, they weren't just handing out brochures, okay? They were convening joint planning sessions, they had town halls, there was more transparency about what the strategic directions were of the health department. Those health departments that had intense community engagement had a strategic plan. So it was prioritized at a strategic level and embraced as a top priority. They also had dedicated personnel whose jobs were to serve as community navigators and ombudsmen to diverse sectors of their community. They also had operating budgets so that they could convene meetings, listening sessions, and also public town halls. So sadly, that portfolio is not robust in, you know, among the 3,000 or so health departments across the United States. They also had granting mechanisms to partner with community-based organizations. But I don't want to overemphasize the work that needs to go on in the public health infrastructure to the detriment of understanding where we can do more innovative things. I had a spokesperson from a Latino health NGO say, many grants are going to get us many change. And so really, we do need to create more innovative financing mechanisms to get resources to community-based and faith-based organizations that have deep roots, particularly in underserved communities of color, and create a sustainable community health infrastructure. Many of these also have relationships with a variety of community health workers. So we need to really beef up not just the public health infrastructure, but the community health sector.
Well, that is so important, and I'm so glad you highlighted that. And I think as one of our guests several weeks ago said, one thing about this pandemic, there isn't anybody in the United States at this point that doesn't understand what a public health person is, what a public health specialist is, because we've seen how important it is. But I wonder if we could ask you to comment on another area of your work.
Sure.
We have the vaccine now, but no vaccine against mental health distress. And we have seen mental health distress writ large throughout this pandemic. There's always been disparities in access to mental health, generally not enough to go around for everybody anyway, but particularly for our communities that have been hardest hit. And I know this is an area that your group has been focused on, the collective trauma of the pandemic and its impact on mental health. Is there a public health approach to this as well, or is it about trying to get up more of our traditional clinical services? What is your team thinking about as you look at the impact? And here we're speaking of both adults and certainly children, where we understand the data is, if anything, even more troubling.
Right. It is important to think about a broad array of psychological difficulties that have been exacerbated by the pandemic. For many people, it is the ongoing protracted distress associated with the pandemic's financial mm-hmm. and physical impacts. So there's that ongoing stress. There are individuals who, outside of the pandemic, have their clinical conditions well under control, but because there's been an interruption in delivery of services, and for some, telehealth may not be the most beneficial form of the delivery of mental health care. There are folks for whom their symptoms are being exacerbated because of interruption of care, in addition to this distress. We have children of adults who are struggling oftentimes to balance household budgets right. when there's been an interruption in employment and food insecurity. And we also have healthcare workers and public health workers mm-hmm. of all kinds who are being stretched to their limits in terms of the actual work, in terms of hours, but also the trauma of, for instance, being present, and caring for a patient who is dying and cannot connect with their family. And just to witness that type of human suffering can wear away at folks. So there are workforce resilience issues. So there's a lot of different needs. All that is happening against the backdrop in our country of lack of parity between mental health and physical health, right. Lack of a well-developed workforce with various skills. There's also, our financing mechanisms are there more to shore up physical health needs than mental health needs mm-hmm. In terms of insurance. And so we have systems that on a good day are not meeting everyone's needs, happening at the same time that we see a spike in a variety of mental and behavioral health needs. Colleagues and I have talked about, we see that the epi curve that shows the numbers of cases related to COVID-19. But, there is a shadow pandemic that doesn't have quite the same representation that's more of a mental health impact. Mm-hmm. And that will be lingering, despite a vaccination coming around to interrupt transmission and reduce physical health burdens. We don't have, as you said, a vaccination that's going to offset the mental trauma.
I want to pull the thread on the issue that you were just addressing around needs. And there are a number of them. We certainly talked about the behavioral health needs amongst the full population, the social determinants of health, housing, food insecurity, the lack of adequate workforce, which sort of brings me to talking about the new administration, the new sheriffs in town, and also a new opportunity, a new leadership team, and also a large commitment that looks like it's around the corner, $1.9 trillion. And I wanted to get some of your thoughts about what recommendations you might have, certainly using the lens of equity. I know the Biden administration put forth an initiative to bring 1 million vaccines a week to community health centers to really focus in on the BIPOC community throughout the nation. But as you look at and size up the administration in terms of its personnel, and then any recommendations that you have as the new administration navigates through all of these issues.
I think what's important, and this we try to convey to state and local officials in the equity and vaccination report, is that there are these urgent needs that have to be met. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we really should be engaging in a more integrated cross-sector recovery planning process mm-hmm. that gets at the multiple needs and the systemic improvements that are necessary. So if we take the example of public health. Could we be generating systems both locally and nationally that put more people of color in leadership positions? Mm-hmm. Do we have our local community colleges developing degree programs that can create spaces both in emergency management and public health more for underserved communities of many kinds? Start the long-term recovery strategizing now. Don't postpone it. It should be taking place simultaneously with a response. I know people look at vaccination as sort of kicking off recovery. Personally, I look at it as sort of containing the acute crisis. Mm-hmm. And that longer term recovery, we really do need to pay attention to. So we need mental health, public health, healthcare, education, social services, emergency management, all at the table, thinking about these longer term issues, getting more people of color in decision-making positions, including those who are making decisions about financing, mm-hmm. I think is a long-term goal that we need to have in mind. You know, with mental health, it isn't just meeting the needs, for instance, of hard-hit communities of color. Are they being treated by physicians and therapists who have roots in their communities, BIPOC communities? And so those workforce development issues, I think, are quite critical.
And we've been speaking today with Dr. Monica Shock-Spanna. She's the co-chair of the Working Group on Equity in COVID-19 Vaccination, or CommuniVax. And they have a new report, Equity in Vaccination, a plan to work with communities of color toward COVID-19 recovery and beyond. Follow their work. See the full report by going to centerforhealthsecurity.org, or you can follow them on Twitter at JHSPH for Johns Hopkins School of Public Health _CHS. Monica, we want to thank you for your tireless efforts to shine a light on these incredibly important public health issues now and well into the future, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks, Mark and Margaret. My pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Laurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Laurie, what have you got for us this week?
The virus SARS-CoV-2 can lead to illness with the disease COVID-19. A virus is an infectious agent that requires a host cell in which to replicate. A disease is the result of the virus replicating in a body and making someone sick. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, explained this distinction between infection with the virus and the disease in an interview on CNN, saying that with vaccination against COVID-19, quote, you could be prevented from getting clinical disease and still have the virus that is in your nasopharynx because you could get infected. A viral video that has racked up hundreds of thousands of views distorted those comments, falsely suggesting that a COVID-19 vaccine authorized in the U.S. doesn't, quote, protect you from COVID. The vaccine does protect against the disease COVID-19. Fauci was cautioning that it may not prevent someone from contracting the virus. Specifically, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was tested in a phase 3 randomized trial in which people were counted as having COVID-19 if they developed at least one symptom of the disease, such as a fever, cough, or shortness of breath, and tested positive for the SARS-CoV-2 virus within 4 days. The vaccine was 95% effective in preventing COVID-19 disease in adults. Moderna's vaccine was similarly effective, 94.1%, based on a COVID-19 definition of at least 2 systemic symptoms and 1 respiratory symptom, along with a positive test for SARS-CoV-2. The trials, however, did not immediately evaluate how well the vaccines were able to prevent infection. This is relevant because while many people develop at least some symptoms, some people do not. So Fauci and public health experts have advised the public to continue to wear a mask and follow public health precautions after being vaccinated. There is a good chance that the authorized COVID-19 shots will help limit transmission to some degree. That is common with vaccines that cannot shield against infection, but do defend against illness. but it remains an open question for the COVID-19 vaccines. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Students of public health are often tasked with devising interventions for addressing some of health's biggest challenges. And for Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health students Dan Wexler and Priya Patel, their idea netted an award and launched a business idea at the same time. The students were tasked with addressing food insecurity in underserved parts of the world, including in neighborhoods in their own backyard. Families living in high poverty, low resource area, and finding fresh, affordable, healthy food in neighborhoods with no grocery stores or food markets. They thought of the current trend of healthy mail order meals services like Blue Apron and wondered, what if we modified that business model to serve the needs of those living in food deserts? Wexler and his partner sourced food delivery companies that could provide prepackaged meal kits with all ingredients included, even spices, dressings, and recipes. And instead of home delivery approach, they designed refrigerated kiosks that could easily be placed in local neighborhoods. Wexler says they wanted to make the idea of healthy eating and meal preparation as simple as possible.
I think the biggest change is that there is no delivery system door-to-door per se, and that by going and setting up these kiosks in the community, you can have a very lean design. You don't need a storefront. You don't need to pay for shipping. You don't need to have in-box refrigeration. And you are very much addressing the need of access by physically saying, hey, here is healthy food. It's convenient because everything you need is in the box. The directions are simple and very picture-based. There's a lot of literacy issues. And so just really thinking about how can we take all those lean design principles to facilitate access that really, I think, make it a solution that has the potential for impact.
And they also conducted research with local ethnic groups to create recipes that would resonate with their families.
And we just went down to the community and did taste testing at the farmers market and talked to people and said, you know, do you like this? What do you want to be able to eat for dinner? How do you want to cook? So basically, we have some dishes that are similar textures, similar spices. One thing that we found is there's a little bit of contention between parents who want to eat more traditional foods and kids who want to eat more American foods. And we tried to alleviate that and bridge those gaps. So one of our recipes, for instance, is a chicken pot pie pasta. So it's kind of American. It's fun sounding, but also we use a lot of traditional seasonings and spices.
Customers can simply walk to the kiosk and purchase their meal kits with the SNAP cards or cash. And they added benefits. The kiosk will be run by the residents of the neighborhood, giving them an opportunity to purchase the kiosk and run them like a franchise, offering an economic benefit to the community as well. A low-cost, portable, healthy meal service placed in portable kiosk in food desert neighborhoods, offering families a simple solution to address the problem of poor nutrition. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.